Do not adjust your radio frequency. This is not a test. This is the Artist First Network.
Cool. Welcome to another broadcast of Bigfoot Central on the Artist First Radio Network. Send your questions and comments to dj@artistfirst.com. We'll read them on the air. Now, here they are, MK Davis and Don Monroe. Gentlemen, take it away.
Hey, how's everybody this evening? Yeah, I appreciate the time they go on the air here and air some of our real world things that we've discovered in our time. And it's a pleasure to be here, folks. And I want you to know that we're out for the truth, MK and I, and all things we look into. And we're not here to make any impressions on anybody. You bring out the facts, and I think some new things you ought to learn about.
Yeah, let me start out by mentioning that Don here has been through quite an ordeal with being bitten on the ankle by a brown recluse spider. He's a pretty tough guy under almost all circumstances. I've seen him fall off a cliff and just take off his belt and bind up his arm and walk out. But this spider really did him some sure enough damage. Talk about it a little bit, Don.
Well, not too much, but yeah, it has been a real bad 4 months. I got bit in March, and it's been a real tussle ever since. And those who know about brown recluse spiders know that 6% can die. And it affects you many ways, including psychologically, and that didn't hurt me much. Anyway, the bite swole my foot to 3 times the size, and it's still up there some, but it's going down. I got a little more promise last few days. I'll be back in my canoe in a few more days, so I'm not too worried. But I have quite an ordeal about 6 different veteran hospitals and some private doctors, but I'm going to make it. I told MK I'd be a bartender or a barber.
Well, it's the reason why it's relevant is because tonight's show is about the trip that Don and I took back into California and also into Oregon at the Bluff Creek area primarily, and Don was not able to make the hike in. The gates were locked. We hiked in. It's a trip down there about 10 and a half miles. I hiked in with Ken Ittings from Alaska. Ken is a good friend of Don's and a good friend of mine, and he was a real trooper, I'm telling you. He had his own foot problems from his early days when he had polio as a child. But it slowed him, but it didn't stop him, and he went every step of the way. What I want to talk about a little bit is kind of what we saw. I've got a lot of really good high quality pictures posted, and some of the things that that I noticed, the area is it's not what it once was. If you'll just go to the Bigfoot Central page, go to the Artist First page first, and then click on the Bigfoot Central button, and it'll take you to the on-air page, and then you can click on the button there for the show, for the photos for the night show. So I think we have quite a few, 30-something, I believe. So the first photo, you'll see me packing my backpack, and we just began our little trek or ordeal, whatever you want to call it. It's quite a walk for me. And it wasn't that many months ago that I was down with knee surgery and back surgery, so I was really pleased that I was able to make that. The second photo there being, it looks like a volcano. I don't know if it's a volcano or not, but, it looks like the pictures I've seen. So I took its picture. But if you look at the third one, you'll see a track there, and that's in the roadbed. And it's just to the left of that rock there, that in the center there, kind of off to the right, and you can see the impression. The reason why I'm making a point of it is that if you look at that roadbed, it's soft. It's not hard like it used to be. It used to be packed, and it was like pavement. But what the Forest Service did was to go down there and chisel plow it deep plow it and turn it over. And now it's soft. You know, you can make tracks in it, and it washes. So the road's beginning to wash and deteriorate rapidly now that it's been chisel plowed. So this is the road going down to the film site that's been referred to as the Bat Box Road. And so it is now rendered impassable. You can't go there by vehicle. You have to either walk in or you may possibly get horses in there. I don't know. There's a couple of big washouts that I even kind of wonder about that. If you look at picture number four, you'll see a rock slide. And that rock slide, 2009, we went through there in Don Suburban. So you can see that there's quite a deterioration in those just very quickly, just a few short years. Once this type of deterioration begins, you know, if they don't come in there with some big machinery and fix it and make it right, then it's going to completely be, you know, gone in just a few short years. The only way we were able to make it in was to walk. Now, Ken and I were walking, and I was, you know how you get kind of tired, and you kind of get to walking with your head down, looking down. And I was doing that, and I heard something breathe real loud, like that, and I looked up, and I was face-to-face with a bear, a really big one. And Ken said it was black, but I was in a little better position, and the sun was backlighting it, and I can see the hair had a little red tinge to it. But the bear was walking with its head down, too. And another 3 or 4 seconds, and we'd have bumped heads. And I said, bear, and he looked up. And we locked eyes for a second, and he jumped off the road. And I had a camera around my neck, and I could not get a picture of that bear. So as far as, you know, as a picture of a Sasquatch goes, It really is a hard thing to do. If when you see something like that, your first instinct is to look at it. I mean, not to take its picture. you know, it's almost a reaction. Just I had a plastic walking pole, a little piece of PVC pipe, and that's all I had. And of course, Ken had a sidearm, but he didn't have time to get it out either. So if the bear had wanted us, he had us. But I tell you about fight or flight. You know, there was nowhere for us to run. This bear was at point-blank range. And there was no fear involved. You know, it was more or less just reactionary type stuff.
I got to say here, MK, you've been followed by mountain lions down there, and you've had this bear encounter. Never once down our trip down there, we ever failed not to see a bear, one or two, you know. And it's really kind of comical to me to hear this because I wasn't along. I wish I had been. So it's been kind of interesting to see what the outcome would have been. But MK is not an unbrave person, but he's from the South, and the Western country is a little different. Like I go down the South, it's different to me, too. But I heard a story secondhand from Ken and them both separately, and it was about the same thing. And they both, all three agreed that the bear agreed, too, that they all didn't want to bump heads, you know.
Yeah, but you know what? I'm glad the bear, me and the bear were thinking the same thing. but you know, Don, for just a second there, or maybe 30 seconds to a minute, you know, when they talk about do cavemen exist? Yeah, they do. I was one. For 30 seconds there, it was the very primitive part of a person came out in me. I would have done whatever it took, you know, if I had to grab the bear's tongue and pull it out. You know, if he'd have kind of got on me, you know, he would have had, you know, he would have had to deal with me. It wouldn't have been an easy thing, I can tell you that, unless he got a lucky punch in. Because, I mean, I was ready, you know, the inner part of me. You know, it was the fight or flight thing. It was no chance for flight, so fight came out. And maybe he sensed that or whatever, but he took off the other way, and it never did occur. So, but it was a feeling in me that I've never had before. And you know, I guess I realized, you know, that deep within us all, you know, there's a certain primitive nature.
Well, this has another side to it, too. You see, folks, that when that bear's on a trail that close to MK in that circumstance, it tells me one more thing. I've hunted bears many years. And anyway, so this bear was unaware of people being in the area very often. And it wasn't that alert. Now, usually a black bear is very hard to get next to and on its own ground unless it comes after food. And so that encounter was, to me, somewhat of a telltale incident that would tell you that the bears in that area are not accustomed to people as we know ourselves too much. And so that's important to me, too, a little bit because of that other circumstances. Because bears are usually, they can hear better than we can see, and they can feel better than the eagle can see. So, you know, they feel the vibrations on the ground. And walking along like he was, it was really quite a story, actually, to get right down to it.
Yeah, well, you know, like I said, Donna, I didn't have any idea or inclination. I was looking down, and he was looking down. For whatever reason, he was walking with his head looking straight down. And when I saw him first, he didn't see me. He was still looking down. Another, you know, 3 or 4 seconds, and we'd have been in each other's arms. You know, so, but nevertheless, it all worked out. But it does kind of tell you that the area is primitive. And what you're seeing down there is the Forest Service. I got the distinct impression that they are letting it go back to the wilderness that it once was when it was called the primitive area. In other words, no road access. So when I got down to the creek, when I got down, Ken and I, we saw more fresh tracks that we took to be Sasquatch tracks because there weren't people in there. I mean, it was, the gates were locked. No vehicle that could even get down there. No sign, no evidence of people. These than I have ever seen down there. Don, they were just up and down that creek everywhere.
Well, you see, there's been the destruction of the road conditions, and people who would go there wouldn't go there, and these people, the wild people call them that, they know this too. They're more, they're less reluctant to leave tracks, and they're not at all as cautious as normal. Now, folks, you've got to realize, MK and I both believe implicitly in Sasquatch, and that's something you've got to understand. We aren't just putting out your hearsay. They do exist, and I know for sure. I've seen them, and MK and I both believe in them implicitly. And these creatures are out there in the woods more than people realize, and they're a wild-type people, and that's my belief. But, yeah, the reason the tracks are down there because they're not being near as cautious, because it's obviously why they aren't so cautious without machinery going around there.
Well, there's an advantage to walking in, and I've done it twice. And you were with me the first time. You see more things when you walk in quietly without an invasive style, you know, like you would if you came in with vehicles, you know, with engines running and the horns blaring and, you know, all that type thing, you know. Just easing in there on foot, you up your odds of seeing something as rare as a Sasquatch. If you go to the picture, number six picture, you'll see what's happening to the roads. This is what the chisel plowing has done. Anywhere there's water coming across the road, it cuts into the road, and you see right there that's not a passable thing right there. It's pretty bad. That just in 2009, this did not exist, and we could drive right through there. In picture number seven, you look across the way, and you'll see a cliff there, and there's a road right below the cliff. You can make it out through the trees. That's the road on the other side of the film site that used to come down to the film site. And the loggers would come to fit down that road with the 18-wheelers and get the logs. And the film site itself was a logger's landing. That's what's left of the road. The road doesn't make it all the way down anymore. But that's the remains of it. And that's where Don and I went. We climbed up that hill to that spot. And those culverts are on the other side, somewhere down in there along those gullies below that road. And then there was a special place that we wanted to try to go to this time, but were not able to make it up there due to the tree falls from a heavy snow. Up the hill, the tree falls were so thick that you couldn't even see the ground for them. You would have to walk literally on treetops. And we weren't able to stay as long as we wanted to stay. I had some personal issues that had come up at the last minute where my wife's aunt had passed away in her sleep. And I was trying to keep up with what was going on back home, so I didn't want to stay out of touch too long down in this drainage. If you look at number 8, you'll see Ken there. He took a little time to rest his feet and take care of them. This is the old Bat Box Road. Actually, there's a road that's older than this road. This Bat Box Road is a secondary road that was built to replace one earlier that had had problems. And the one earlier figured prominently in some of the photos that were taken of the Patterson area in the early days. All of this is going by the wayside now. It's not going to be available to researchers unless you were willing to do something extraordinary like we did, like walk in. You can't. It's not going to be easy entering that area anymore. The picture number 9 is just the rugged beauty of the land. It's just some of the most rugged land there is in the United States. Probably there's not. If you look at those hills and hilltops, there's not a lot of flat anywhere. It's mostly up and down, and it's steep and rugged and hard and wild. Number 10, Ken's trying to go across the, that's Bluff Creek there, and Ken's trying to cross it without getting his feet wet, and he's successfully did so a couple of three times. So he's the quintessential mountain man. Number 11 is the area on the Patterson film site, on that sandbar, that nothing grows in. Nothing will grow there. Nothing was growing there in 2009. Nothing's growing there now. All around it, it's thick, lush, green vegetation, but in this spot right here, it's dead. And Don, you remember that we tested that.
Yeah, it's alkaline. It's alkaline content, and it had different properties. I can't remember the numbers now, but definitely with lime. It was quick lime what it was.
It was slightly alkaline with a conductivity pretty still pretty high. So there's a reason why, because that's an acidic forest. Everything about that forest is acidic. So most of the plants, nearly all the plants around there are acid-loving plants. And when you get something on the alkaline side, they won't grow there. So there you go. That's what you see there. Now, number 12, that's looking upstream at the Patterson film site, and that opening you see how much it has grown up. Don, even since 2009, it has become, just bushy. It's just a matter of time, and it won't be even recognizable.
I might add here, for anybody that claimed they flew helicopters into that country, and I'm not pointing fingers out there, but there's been a documentary done recently, not too long ago, where it showed a whole flock of people in there on helicopters and so on, and claiming the spot to the Patterson site and so on. Well, take a look at that kind of belief. You know, those kind of claims are pretty hard to validate sometimes. And MK's making me on a point there. It's just almost too rugged to even get a horse into, let alone a helicopter in there.
Well, it's just the sandbar itself just grew up with thick brush. And when Patterson took his film, or when the film was taken, it was after a flood, and the flood had cleaned all that brush and everything out, and it takes a good long while for it all to come back. There it has. It's pretty much, and it's steady coming, too. And number 13, you'll see, that's basically where Ken and I camped right there. There was a little spit of sand just out of view to the left, and we set up camp there. Took us all day to make it in and all day to get out. About a 40-degree incline all the way out of there for 2 or 3 miles. So, you know, it's tough on an old guy. But I tell you what, there's not, you'll see it in a way that you could never see it otherwise by walking in. You know, number 14 shows a metal tag that was on a tree. And this metal tag gives all the information about that tree. And it said it was planted in the year of 1986. And if you'll scroll down to number 17, it's a couple of pictures below that, you'll see Ken standing by that tree. And look at the size of the tree. It's nearly a mature tree. So from 1986, when it was a seedling, until now, it's nearly a grown tree. So these are fast-growing firs. And the Patterson Film site itself, the area around there, does not necessarily contain the same trees now that it did at that time. So, you know, I just wanted to make that point that these fir trees grow back very fast. And that the fir trees in this area are not the original trees that dominated. This area originally had hardwoods when men first came in, white men, Europeans first came into that area. The oaks in much of the Native American population survived off acorns in that area. So now the firs dominate because of harvesting the hardwood and then replanting firs. You know, it helps to know a little history of the place because, you know, it's not untouched wilderness. It is wilderness, but it's not untouched. Man has been here from the get-go. At one time, there were 10,000 Chinese gold mining in this area, laboring up in there with hydraulic mining processes. Back up a little bit, just to number 16, and you'll see Ken, Don, and Bob Smallsbach. And Bob was our gracious host there in Happy Camp. And I can't say enough good things about Bob. He really you know, put himself out to let us stay with him and sponsor us there during this trip, and his family as well. They were just, you know, very good to us. And Ken doctored on Don a little bit there and tried to get him his foot back in shape. It just took time, didn't it, Don?
Yeah, it still takes time. Yeah, it takes a little more time yet. Patience is the only way to get somewhere. Sometimes it's slow. You what, we're not done, and the year 2013 is ahead of us, and 12 is not over.
Okay, number, still number 19, going on. Yep. Number 19 there, if you look at number 19, that's the go road, what they call the go road. You see that's still snow on the road? The go stands for Gasquet to Orleans. Gasquet is a coastal town in the northern part, most extreme northern part of California, and the road goes from Gasquet inland to Orleans there on Highway 96 below Happy Camp. So this was an attempt to travel that road, but it did not work out because this road had only, the gates were unlocked, but it was in miserable shape. From the rock falls and from tree falls, you see in number 20, I'm sitting on a log that we actually had to get a camp hatchet and hatchet our way through the log and pull it out of the way. And after all that work, it ended up, you go to number 22, you'll see me standing by the next obstacle, which was just around the corner, and it almost a room-sized boulder. We couldn't do anything with that. So you see the kind of a rugged country that is, you know. These roads are only seasonally open, and then under certain conditions. And so whenever rocks fall like that, they're just closed until somebody can get in there with machinery to do it. The whole entire area was dominated by the very theme of Bigfoot. The Happy Camp is on 96, which was called the Bigfoot Scenic Highway. you see that these merchants there in Happy Camp, they all had something Bigfoot themed or related. So you see the Bigfoot statue outside in 21 in this little coffee house and book house. And you scroll on down to number 23, you see this really, really large statue of a Bigfoot there in Happy Camp, kind of in the middle of the road there, or parking area in the road. And it's a very impressive piece of work. That thing is made of metal. So, you know, it's like I said, it's one of the best that I've seen. What a piece of work. They put a lot into it. And there at the Happy Camp at number 24 at the Happy Camp, California post office, you'll see another carving of Bigfoot there at the post office there in among all the little pretty flowers. And then number 25 is a little Karuk child by the name of Chris, who allowed me to take his picture. The Karuks were very gracious. Don and I was able to give a presentation to the Karuks and show them some things from the Patterson film and the Patterson film site and some of the related films with it. And they were very gracious and allowed me the time to do that and thanked me for it. And I left them with a few files that they could mull over. And you see me sitting there, number 26, outside their little place there. The Karuk. Is it, am I saying it right, Don? Is that correct, Karuk?
Yeah, it's pretty close.
And then you see Don there sitting there. I got his picture. And number 27. And now, let's talk about the footprint that we found a mile and a half back in the woods near Sweet Home, Oregon, along the Santiam River. Now, Don was able to be there. First of all, we'll talk about number 28. Now, Don, this is the petroglyphs that we went to see back there on the Santiam River. And these were on the wall of an overhang, cliff overhang. And you said you thought that this was not bear prints, but Sasquatch prints. Now,
well, it was a mixture there of these are probably close to paleo times. They're old petroglyphs, and they're very well done. You know, Native Americans are very artistic, and they do their own kind of thing, and you got to read it right. A blob on the wall has to have indications of, you know, has to be the same all over throughout when you get looking at multiple numbers. And a lot of people who are really not into petroglyph reading just go by them pretty quick and okay. But when the proportions on the heel, for example, the toes or whatever, is uniform on throughout the whole 9 yards of the petroglyph display, well, you start seeing things that they're trying to tell you about them, their own feet and about other feet that are not theirs. And there was different kinds on that wall, indicating to me with a message to their own kind or anybody traveling to the country actually or today that there's more than one kind of people walking in those forests. And being this is Salmon River, ages, ancient times, it's been long been a Salmon River from the ocean there, Pacific. The salmon migrate up that stream every year, both spring and fall seasons. And this is a natural place for Sasquatch to go. We're close to the shore of the river, not too far from there, really. And Sasquatch are known for liking salmon. And so they are in Alaska and all the way down to the whole north. West, they're known for this, and in Idaho, too, and so on. Anyway, well, we walked the trail. I had to hobble in there. I hobbled in twice, in fact, the mile and a half, and over to a waterfall on that stupid leg. Anyway, the thing was, my speed was pretty slow, and I got to look around pretty good. And we come to one section about, well, I'd say 40 yards long, where there's mud puddles on the trail, you might say that, muddy water and mud, and a lot of trucks of people going to see the Ted petroglyphs and so on, including our own. Among those tracks were some larger tracks that weren't ours, all barefooted, and they were, and there was no reason for a barefooted person to be back in those mountains. I mean, it would just be almost ludicrous to do it that time of the year, that time of the season, and with the bugs and so on, too. And so anyway, I noticed these things, and we all talked about it, and we looked them over, and I saw at least two of the entities that were definitely not us, that had heels,
I told this before on the radio, but the heels to me are the most important thing on the whole foot to identify the possibility of a Sasquatch, because the human anatomy does not show a heel on anybody, no matter who you are, or what race or whatever you are, of my humanity, more than 2 3/4 inches wide on the heel.
Let me direct the listeners down to picture number 32, and that's the footprint that Don's describing right there.
And I can tell you, I put my finger down, and I'm not sure you even noticed it. I had a walking stick, but I noticed the depth in the mud, and, you know, it was not, how you say it, logistics tell you that it was heavy enough to be that proportion. It wasn't a fake, and there's no one in the area who knew he was in there for what reasons, and doing any Bigfoot research at all. So we had four or five people along. I forget who was all there. But anyway, they all agreed it looked like something different than us. And I would say 99% that they were Sasquatch tracks. So I didn't have casting material to cast them. I wasn't prepared for that this time. I have my own kind of reasons. I was out of it. But I do determine that they were very much Sasquatch tracks. And they'll be there again sometime. I go back there another year, and we get the same ones again, probably in the same area. They'll live there in the vicinity.
One thing that struck me about the footprint is that the big toe is significantly longer than all the rest of the toes, and although there's a certain number of people who have a longer toe, big toe, it's not that common. Most of the time, it's one of the other toes that are longer. But
that's true.
But nevertheless, of course, I'm no track expert, so I mean that's why I rely on other people to tell me about things like this. Don, you pointed out the items that made you think it is. Besides the death, What other features on it made you think that this was not?
Well, then the midfoot, you know, they call it tarsal, the mid-tarsal break, people call it that area. Well, there's a certain width there that it's uniform to us and to them differently. They're very similar, but when you see these tracks that they show you at the shows and things, there's a certain amount of that you suspect to be fakery, and it could be it sometimes. But there are certain things that are in the real track that you just can't put aside, and this had... They're not flat-footed exactly. Right? The people think they are. They're not flat-footed. They have a different arch, and the arch is a little different than ours. It's more spread out. And it's hard to explain on a phone like this, or a telephone, but it's our feet are more like a, I don't know how you say it, a flipper almost compared to theirs. They're more, their foot's on the ground longer and out of a shoe and so on. It's got a certain look to it that's it's strong all throughout. Ours is kind of weak and strong in places.
About the width of the heel. Yeah,
the heel width is almost 4 inches, and that's what I'm trying to get back to that there. I've got numerous casts in my collection, and none of them ever have a heel that is not proportionally wider than a human being as we know ourselves considerably. And it's even on the small ones that are babies. We showed on this show here a few months ago. I took the Bluff Creek of a small baby one, a 5-inch track, and the heel on that is as wide as a human's full-grown adult, so one of us. So the heel is important. It shows that they have a large body above them to support. It's like a pole in the river to hold up a bridge. You got to have a support.
When they put their weight on it, everything kind of spreads wide. It's got more surface mm-hmm. area on the ground, right?
That's true. It's more like you just said it, you know, like a support to a bridge. You need to have more support to a bigger body, and our bodies are kind of frail in some respects compared to theirs. We aren't built to quite the same way. And human beings are ugly. They're actually frail. They're built insignificant. We've adapted to things, but we're still puny compared to the wild animals and wild people, probably. And so that's what we're looking at there.
Well, you know, the St. Anne River was just a beautiful river, and the scenery was just, I mean, just breathtaking. It was really quite an experience there. And I got a picture of you, Don, talking about your horse manes and the braiding of the horse manes. They're giving a little presentation there at the campground. We had a really good time, and there number 33 is a picture of Patty Reinholdt. Patty and her husband Bob hosted us or sponsored us there for a few days, and it was, you know, the gracious nature of these people, these friends of ours. You know, I can't overstate it. It's without their hospitality, the trip would be much more difficult, would it not, Don?
Yeah, the Santiana River, just one more thing here, is also one of the wild rivers. It's considered a wild river you can kayak and canoe down, which is it's beautiful, and people should go there for just the Santiana Highway. It goes over to Bend, Oregon, finally, and goes from the Sisters over to the coast. It's a well-traveled Sasquatch route for many generations have been talking about that also, so it's a Bigfoot country.
Well, number 30 and number 31 are a couple of more different footprints that we got there at Bluff Creek. There, you know, in the soft humus and sand alongside the creek. You can see how deep they go, how long they are, how wide they are. I think this particular track that you're looking at with the tape stretched on it was a good 6 inches wide across the heel. And Don, would that incline you to think that it was something other than...
Yeah, I'm like I say, 99%. If I had a cast to look at closely, I'd know more about it. But I do think I looked very, very closely at the heel marks in that mud and sand, and it was very defined, and it was not irregular where you could say, well, maybe it's there, maybe it's not. It was definitely there in certain depths and certain widths, and it's just not conducive to our own selves as we know ourselves at all. I think in foot tracks all over the country, all over the South Pacific, could clear down as far as Australia on different peoples and races of man, and I've never found a heel yet that was bigger than 2 3/4 unless the person was distorted somehow or something, or, you know, has some reason for it. But our normal person, it doesn't exceed 2 3/4. Measure your foot tonight in your shower. Find out about it, folks. You'll find out how big you are. Still about bigger than, it could be maximum 3 inches if it ever got that far. I never saw one yet. So, yeah, it was definitely something very different than one of us.
And number 30, the track number 30 there, shows the hump in the middle of the track. You know, you see where it's dug on one side and dug on the other, and a hump in the middle. Now, when I did experiments there, and I got it posted on YouTube, where I walked in the style of the Patterson Sasquatch. In other words, I stuck my leg out in front and drove the heel, rocked over, and pushed off with the ball. And every time, it made that same hump in the middle. Now what that tells me is that it's anybody can make that type of track if they want that style. It's less a function of the foot and more of a function of the walking style. And that's still an indicator that it may be a Sasquatch, because people don't usually walk like that. You know, people usually keep their legs under them, and they don't produce the big hump in the middle. But if you extend the leg way out and drive the heel, you will produce this ridge in the middle nearly every time.
And you can't be flat-footed and do that either. The flat foot won't do that.
So if I see a track, especially in the Bluff Creek area, and it's got that hump, you know, I'm inclined to think that it may be a Sasquatch that did it, you know, based upon their walking style, what you see in the film. But there's nothing guaranteed there.
One more thing I forgot to say here, MK. These tracks they found were made in an obvious place. Now, this is interesting, too. These Sasquatch are smart enough to know if they're off to the side of the trail or so on, it'd be obvious that they're trying to hide themselves somewhat. But when they walk down the place, the corridor, you might say, across the carpet where everybody else walks, there's not a chance of even noticing it, probably. And most people wouldn't notice it. And slow as I was going along, poking along like an old man like I am, I could see those doggone tracks real clearly. And I remember calling over to one of our mates there with us, and we all agreed this was different. We all called each other together, and we discussed it. Yeah, no, definitely they're walking down the trailway just like one of us would do it, and for obvious reasons not to be seen. It's just another deterrent, another way to cause diversion from being unnoticed, what it is.
Yeah, it's hiding in plain sight, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I'd like to take the last part of the show and discuss a different film from another time. Recently, someone published or posted the raw video from a clip that was originally taken in the 1990s by a forestry worker by the name of Paul Freeman. And, of course, this particular video has been controversial down through the years. And a fellow who goes by the name of Joe Black had done some work on it and had come to some conclusions on it, and it got me interested in it again, because when something comes out in a better form, I want to look at it again. So what I did was, I took the video and I stabilized it. And of course, we have new technologies now that are able to do that in great quality. So I stabilized the footage and took the hand motion out of the footage, and I was very, very surprised at what I found. I've got a link up here on the page, the photo page. It says YouTube link for tonight's show. So if you're on that page and you want to click on that, what you'll see is a zoom oscillating file. In the very center of this file, as it runs, you'll see a black figure or a dark figure. And that's the back of the Sasquatch in the Freeman footage walking dead away from it. Okay, you'll look and see the edges of the photos are moving around. That's the stabilization process that keeps it dead center. Okay, now this, if you let this thing run, it's going to zoom in. And it's going to get closer and closer and closer as the file runs. And on the left side of the film subject, you're going to see something dangle out of its arms, out of its arm on the left side. You can see the head above the shoulder, and you can see the legs dangle below the arm. And it has the appearance of being a small version of what it is. Two legs dangle, and you may get an inkling or idea from it exactly what was going on when Mr. Freeman took the footage. It's a pretty fascinating clip. I was very surprised to see this in such clarity, but the stabilization process makes things much easier to see. So that's new technology applied to an older film, and then you can actually get some good interpretation there from what's there. This data has always been there in that film, but it has not always been in such a eye-friendly form. So I like to encourage everyone, if they get a chance, to go there and look at that piece of footage. Now, Mr., if you watch the raw footage, the Paul Freeman raw footage, you'll see that he spends quite a bit of time looking at some fresh tracks along a roadway. He goes to a watering hole, and there's some more fresh tracks there. There's a track that's about 9 inches, he says, and he cast those. And if you look at the track, you can see that it's probably going to be about an 8, maybe 7-inch foot that made the 9-inch track, because of the way the foot makes tracks, in dirt. Well, it's a rather small subject, but it's probably not the one you see in the video with the dangling legs, because that one is an infant. So what have we got going on in the Freeman footage? Is there a clan of them there? He says he distinctly sees two. I don't have it up here, but if you can go to my channel at Greenwave 2010 FB Football, FB, it's an old football channel of mine, you can find the clips of the tracks and see the tracks and things. The Sasquatch actually comes right in front of him and looks back, stops and looks at him for 3 or 4 seconds really hard, and then it moves on across. And Mr. Freeman is talking to himself during this time. And he says, "Oh, there it goes," as it walks across. So I don't know if you've ever been by yourself in the woods. You get a little edgy and you find yourself talking out loud to yourself. I don't know if it's kind of one of those things that people do, reactionary, when they feel like maybe there may be something out there or something. That's what he was doing. He follows this trackway, and this trackway is red hot fresh. I mean, just red hot fresh. And all of a sudden, he hears something. And if you go back where it says Paul Freeman on that picture page, Paul Freeman Lone Crow video, click there and listen to it. I'm going to click here, and you probably hear it over the phone here. Hold on. Okay, now that's the sound of a crow, and it crowed four times. But let me tell you, it crowed from exactly the spot where the Bigfoot walked across. A minute or two later. What does that mean? I was told, and I believe it to be true, that they mimic. And one of their favorite things to mimic is a crow or an owl.
And a raven owl, and a catbird.
An owl at night, crow during the day.
And a catbird sometimes.
So, if you got a crow crowing, and you film a Bigfoot there 60 seconds later, well, maybe it wasn't a crow. But what I see and what I get out of the film is that this Bigfoot or Sasquatch stopped dead in his tracks and stared at him. And there was an infant involved and a child involved. And Mr. Freeman was walking toward that clan, following fresh tracks, and talking to himself. So I believe that had he not been talking to himself in the second person, that he might have ended up as one of the stories in Dave Pilotti's Missing 411 book. He walked into a clan that had small ones and an infant, and it looked at him hard. I mean, it looked at him really hard. And had he not spoken to himself, saying, oh, there she goes, there it goes. See, it sounded as if he were talking to another person that the Sasquatch could not see. And it looks to me like, and this is what I'm getting out of it, interpretation-wise, it looks to me like it made a decision to go on based upon the fact that it didn't know where that second person was. So Mr. Freeman might have inadvertently talked himself out of an altercation. And he was lucky. If you've got a hot set of tracks like what you see in that film, and it's obvious that they were just made because it came down to the watering hole, and then it left back the way it came, and you can see the direction of both prints, and they're in light dust, and then when they're around the water hole, they're in mud. He was very, very, very close. And then you hear that crow call right there. I mean, right there where he took the film. So, we get lucky, and you have to reconsider Mr. Freeman's film in the light of those dangling legs, because if you hoax an event, you only get out of it what's built into it by the hoaxer. But if you examine a piece of footage and it continues to yield minutia, data continues to flow, and from all various angles, you get data coming out of the footprints, you get data coming out of the motion, you get data coming out of all over, like the Patterson film has been yielding data for 40 years. It's because it's an uncontrolled live event, and the event was not under the control of a cameraman or any kind of director. So live events contain prodigious amounts of information. And when you get a good version of that film to analyze and to replay and to stabilize and to look at, it will yield continually for a very long time. And that's what you're seeing in Paul Freeman's film. And it does not matter about what kind of person Paul Freeman was, because when data begins to come out in this prodigious way, in this amount, then you have to separate it from its maker, and it has to live or die on its own merits, not on the merits of the filmmaker. Anybody can pull the trigger on a camera. Anybody. It doesn't. When you get the, if they hoaxed it, you can tell it's a hoax. It won't yield but just so much information. You know, it'll be a blurry figure in the road, and that's all it'll be. But when you get this kind of information from a film, it's not likely to be a hoax. So whatever you think of Mr. Freeman, anybody, good or bad, it has little or nothing to do with his footage.
MK, sorry for butting in. We have just a couple minutes left. I wanted to get one email in that I thought was a little exciting. And it's in reference to photo number 15. Dear MK, what is that in the air on photo 15? We've been looking at it, and one of the engineers here thinks, you know, tongue-in-cheek, looks like a UFO. What is that in the sky on photo 15?
I don't know.
Do you see what we're referring to?
I don't know.
It's right there. I mean, for those that can't see the photo at the moment, in the sky, off in the distance, is a elongated, slightly ovalish object sitting right there in the sky. Does not look like a bird to me.
I took the picture, but I did not see the object when I took the picture.
There you go.
Next show.
What the hell is that?
Yeah, well, next show, MK.
This is a high quality picture, so if anybody wants to take a look at it and give it again, a try with their Photoshop or whatever, just right click on it and have at it, and let us know what you find out of it. It's first I've seen it. I'm glad you brought it to my attention. I didn't notice it.
Yeah, they actually referred to a UFO in the email, but we don't want to speculate, folks. Look it up, see what you think, and we're down. We got about 2 minutes. We'll let you guys wrap it up.
Yeah, that's most interesting.
Well, yeah, you know, MK draws mountain lions, bears, and now UFOs. I don't know what else he's going to draw in there.
No, I mean, it looks like a disc.
Yeah, wow.
Well, Don, you remember that place? This was when we went up on the Go Road.
Yeah, I know where it's at.
Now, this mountain range is famous for UFO activity. I mean,
it is, and the people talk about it all the time.
Kenneth Arnold, a little farther north of there, into Washington, along the coast there, is where the first flying saucer term was coined. I don't know. I took the picture, but like I said, I was looking at the scenery. I wasn't looking at the sky. So I don't know what
it is. Proof's in the pudding. Let's go on the pudding next show and see what we can find out about that.
Yeah, see what you can find out between now and then, because we really are absolutely out of time. And gentlemen, on behalf of all of our listeners to this broadcast, we want to thank you for all the great work you do in the world of Bigfooting and contributing to the knowledge and understanding of this topic. You guys are some of the hardest working guys in the world out there, and we're proud to have you on the station.
Well, I tell you what, we appreciate your graciousness and hosting us and letting us have a format here. I do hope that, you know, people are enriched by it.
Don, you get better, man. We're all going to concentrate on your foot and make it good with one of these mental vibe things. If the spider hasn't made you too crazy to recover.
Well, you know, I couldn't go very far to worry about that.
He's going to end up with Spidey powers.
He's a tough guy. Well, we'll let you know what happens, folks, and we should be back on schedule first Tuesday in August. We'll meet you here at that time. Thanks, everybody.
All right, aloha.
Good night, everybody.